This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Redeemer by Joe Nesbø, translated from the Norwegian by Don Bartlett, read for you by John Lee. This recording is dedicated to the memory of Robin Sachs, who passed away suddenly in February 2013. Dear friend and beloved narrator. Who is this that comes from Edom? Coming from Basra, his garments stained crimson. Who is this in glorious apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength? It is I, who announce that right has won the day. It is I, says the Lord, for I am mighty to save. Isaiah chapter 63, verse 1. Part 1. Advent. 1. August 1991. The Stars. She was 14 years old and sure that if she shut her eyes tight and concentrated, she could see the stars through the roof. All around her, women were breathing. Regular, heavy nighttime breathing. One was snoring, and that was Auntie Sarah, who had been given a mattress beneath the open window. She closed her eyes and tried to breathe like the others. It was difficult to sleep, especially because everything around her was so new and different. The sounds of the night in the forest beyond the window in Ørstgård were different. The people she knew from the meetings in the citadel and the summer camps were somehow not the same. She was not the same either. The face and body she saw in the mirror this summer were new. And her emotions, the strange hot and cold currents that flowed through her when the boys looked at her, or when one of them in particular looked at her, Robert. He was different this year, too. She opened her eyes again and stared. She knew God had the power to do great things, even allow her to see the stars through the roof, if it was his wish. It had been a long and eventful day. The dry summer wind had whispered through the corn, and the leaves on the trees danced as if in a fever, causing the light to filter through to the visitors on the field. They had been listening to one of the Salvation Army cadets from the officer training school, talking about his work as a preacher on the Faroe Islands. He was good-looking and spoke with great sensitivity and passion, but she was preoccupied with shooing away a bumblebee that kept buzzing around her head, and by the time it moved off, the heat had made her drowsy. When the cadet finished, all faces were turned to the territorial commander, David Eckhoff, who had been observing them with his smiling young eyes, which were actually over 50 years old. He saluted in the Salvation Army manner, with his right hand raised above his shoulder and pointing to the kingdom of heaven, amid a resounding shout of Hallelujah. Then he prayed for the cadets' work with the poor and the pariahs to be blessed, and reminded them of the Gospel of Matthew, where it said that Jesus, the Redeemer, was among them, a stranger on the street, maybe a criminal, without food and without clothing, and that on Judgment Day the righteous, those who had helped the weakest, would have eternal life. It had all the makings of a long speech, but then someone whispered something, and he said, with a smile, that Youth Hour was next on the program, and today it was Rikard Nilsson's turn. She had heard Rikard make his voice deeper than it was to thank the commander. As usual, he had prepared what he was going to say in writing and memorized it. He stood up and recited how he was going to devote his life to the fight, to Jesus' fight for the kingdom of God. His voice was nervous, yet monotonous and soporific. His introverted glower rested on her. Her eyes were heavy. His sweaty top lip was moving to form the familiar, secure, tedious phrases. So she didn't react when the hand touched her back. Not until it became fingertips, and they wandered down to the small of her back, and lower, and made her freeze beneath her thin summer dress. She turned and looked into Robert's smiling brown eyes, and she wished her skin were as dark as his so that he would not be able to see her blush. "Shh," John had said. Robert and John were brothers. Although John was 1 year older, many people had taken them for twins when they were younger. But Robert was 17 now, and while they had retained some facial similarities, the differences were clearer. Robert was happy and carefree, liked to tease and was good at playing the guitar, but was not always punctual for services in the citadel, and sometimes the teasing had a tendency to go too far, especially if he noticed others were laughing. Then John would often step in. John was an honest, conscientious boy, who most thought would go to officer training school and would, though this was never formulated out loud, find himself a girl in the army. The latter could not be taken for granted in Robert's case. John was 3/4 of an inch taller than Robert, but in some strange way Robert seemed taller. From the age of 12, John had begun to stoop, as though he were carrying the woes of the world on his back. Both were dark-skinned, good-looking, with regular features. But Robert had something John did not have. There was something in his eyes, something black and playful, which she wanted and yet did not want to investigate further. While Rickart was talking, her eyes were wandering across the sea of assembled familiar faces. One day she would marry a boy from the Salvation Army, and perhaps they would both be posted to another town or another part of the country. But they would always return to Östgor, which the army had just bought, and was to be their summer site from now on. On the margins of the crowd, sitting on the steps leading to the house, was a boy with blonde hair stroking a cat that had settled in his lap. She could tell that he had been watching her, but he had looked away just as she noticed. He was the one person here she didn't know, but she did know that his name was Mads Gilstrup, that he was the grandchild of the people who had owned Östgor before, that he was a couple of years older than her, and that the Gilstrup family was wealthy. He was attractive, in fact, but there was something solitary about him. And what was he doing here anyway? He had been there the previous night, walking around with an angry frown on his face, not talking to anyone. She had felt his eyes on her a few times. Everyone looked at her this year. That was new, too. She was jerked out of these thoughts by Robert taking her hand, putting something in it and saying, "Come to the barn when the general-in-waiting has finished. I've got something to show you." Then he stood up and walked off, and she looked down into her hand and almost screamed. With one hand over her mouth, she dropped the object into the grass. It was a bumblebee. It could still move, despite not having legs or wings. At last Rickart finished, and she sat watching her parents and Robert and John's parents moving toward the tables where the coffee was. They were both what army people in their respective Oslo congregations called strong families, and she knew watchful eyes were on her. She walked toward the outhouse. Once she was around the corner, where no one could see her, she scurried in the direction of the barn. "Do you know what this is?" said Robert, with the smile in his eyes and the deep voice he had not had the summer before. He was lying on his back in the hay, whittling a tree root with the penknife he always carried in his belt. Then he held it up, and she saw what it was. She had seen drawings. She hoped it was too dark for him to see her blush again. "No," she lied, sitting beside him in the hay. And he gave her that teasing look of his, as if he knew something about her she didn't even know herself. She returned his gaze and fell back on her elbows. "This is where it goes," he said, and in an instant his hand was up her dress. She could feel the hard tree root against the inside of her thigh, and before she could close her legs, it was touching her underpants. His breath was hot on her neck. "No, Robert," she whispered. "But I made it for you," he wheezed in return. "Stop. I don't want to. Are you saying no to me?" She caught her breath and was unable either to answer or to scream, because at that moment they heard John's voice from the barn door. "Robert! No, Robert!" She felt him relax and let go, and the tree root was left between her clenched thighs as he withdrew his hand. "Come here," John said, as though talking to a disobedient dog. With a chuckle, Robert got up, winked at her, and ran out into the sun to his brother. She sat up and brushed the hay off her, feeling both relieved and ashamed at the same time. Relieved because John had spoiled their crazy game. Ashamed because he seemed to think it was more than that, a game. Later, during grace before their evening meal, she had looked up straight into Robert's brown eyes and seen his lips form one word. She didn't know what it was, but she had started to giggle. He was crazy. And she was, well, what was she? Crazy too. Crazy. And in love? Yes, in love, precisely that. And not in the way she had been when she was 12 or 13. Now she was 14, and this was bigger, more important, and more exciting. She could feel the laughter bubbling up inside her now as she lay there trying to stare through the roof. Auntie Sarah grunted and stopped snoring beneath the window. Something screeched. An owl? She needed to pee. She didn't feel like going out, but she had to. Had to walk through the dewy grass past the barn, which was dark and quite a different proposition in the middle of the night. She closed her eyes, but it didn't help. She crept out of her sleeping bag, slipped on some sandals, and tiptoed over to the door. A few stars had appeared in the sky, but they would disappear when day broke in the east in an hour's time. The cool air caressed her skin as she scampered along, listening to the unidentifiable sounds of the night. Insects that stayed quiet during the day. Animals hunting. Rickard said he had seen foxes in the distant copse. Or perhaps the animals were the same ones that were out during the day, but just made different sounds. They changed, shed their skins, so to speak. The outhouse stood alone on a small mound behind the barn. She watched it grow in size as she came closer. The strange, crooked hut had been made with untreated wooden boards that had warped, split, and turned grey. No windows, a heart on the door. The worst thing about it was that you never knew if anyone was already in there. And she had an instinct that someone was already in there. She coughed so that whoever was there might signal his presence. A magpie took off from a branch on the edge of the wood. Otherwise all was still. She stepped up onto the flagstone, grabbed the lump of wood that passed for a door handle, pulled it. The black room gaped open. She breathed out. There was a flashlight beside the toilet seat, but she didn't need to switch it on. She raised the seat lid before closing the door and fastening the door hook. Then she pulled up her nightgown, pulled down her underwear, and sat down. In the ensuing silence, she thought she heard something. Something that was neither animal nor magpie nor insects shedding skin. Something that moved fast through the tall grass behind the toilet. Then the trickle started and the noise was obscured. But her heart had already started pounding. When she had finished, she quickly pulled up her underpants and sat in the dark, listening. But all she could hear was a faint ripple in the tops of the trees, and her blood throbbing in her ears. She waited for her pulse to slow down. Then she unhooked the catch and opened the door. The dark figure filled almost the entire doorway. He must have been standing and waiting silently outside on the stone step. The next minute she was splayed over the toilet seat and he stood above her. He closed the door behind him.
"You?"
she said.
"Me,"
he said in an alien, tremulous, husky voice. Then he was on top of her. His eyes glittered in the dark as he bit her lower lip until he drew blood, and one hand found the way under her nightgown and tore off her underwear. She lay there crippled with fear beneath the knife blade that stung the skin on her neck, while he kept thrusting his groin into her before he had even got his trousers off, like some crazed, copulating dog.
"One word from you, and I'll cut you into pieces," he whispered,
and not one word issued from her mouth, because she was 14 years old, and sure that if she shut her eyes tightly and concentrated, she would be able to see the stars through the roof. God had the power to do things like that, if it was his wish. 2. Sunday, December 14th, 2003. The visit. He studied his reflected features in the train window, tried to see what it was, where the secret lay, but he saw nothing in particular, apart from the red neckerchief, just an expressionless face and eyes and hair that, approaching the walls of the tunnels between Courcelles and Terne, was as black as the eternal night of the metro. Le Monde lay in his lap, forecasting snow, but above him the streets of Paris were still cold and deserted beneath impenetrable low-lying cloud cover. His nostrils flared and drew in the faint but distinct smell of damp cement, human perspiration, hot metal, eau de cologne, tobacco, wet wool, and bile, a smell they never managed to wash out of the train seats or to ventilate. The pressure created by an oncoming train made the windows vibrate, and the darkness was temporarily banished by the pale squares of light that flashed past. He pulled up the sleeve of his coat and checked his watch, a Seiko SQ50 that he had received as partial payment from a client. There were already scratches on the glass, so he was not sure it was a genuine item. 7:15. It was Sunday evening, and the car was no more than half full. He looked around him. People slept on the metro. They always did. On weekdays in particular. Switched off, closed their eyes and let the daily journey become a dreamless interval of nothing between the red or the blue lines on the metro map. A mute connecting line between work and freedom. He had read about a man who had sat like this for a whole day, eyes closed, to and fro, and it was only when they came to clean the car at the end of the day that they discovered he was dead. Perhaps he had descended into the catacombs for this very purpose, to draw a blue connecting line between life and the beyond in this pale yellow coffin, knowing he would be undisturbed. As for himself, he was forming a connecting line in the other direction, back to life. There was this job tonight, and then the one in Oslo, the last job. Then he would be out of the catacombs for good. A dissonant signal screamed before the doors closed in town. They picked up speed again. He closed his eyes, trying to imagine the other smell. The smell of urinal blocks and hot, fresh urine. The smell of freedom. But perhaps it was true what his mother, the teacher, had said. That the human brain can reproduce detailed images of everything you have seen or heard, but not even the most basic smell. Smell. The images began to flash past on the inside of his eyelids. He had been 15 years old, sitting in the corridor of the hospital in Fukovar, listening to his mother repeat the mumbled prayer to Thomas the Apostle, the patron saint of construction workers, to let God spare her husband. He had heard the rumble of the Serbian artillery firing from the river, and the screams of those being operated on in the infants' ward, where there were no longer any infants, because the women of the town had stopped producing after the siege started. He had worked as an errand boy in the hospital and learned to shut out the noises, the screams, and the artillery, but not the smells. And one smell above all others. Surgeons performing an amputation first had to cut through the flesh to the bone, and then, so that patients did not bleed to death, to use something that looked like a soldering iron to cauterize the blood vessels so that they were closed off. The smell of burned flesh and blood was like nothing else. A doctor came into the corridor and waved him and his mother in. Approaching the bed, he had not dared to look at his father. He had just concentrated on the big brown hand clutching the mattress and trying, as it seemed, to tear it in two. It could have succeeded, for these were the strongest hands in the town. His father was a steel bender. He was the person who went on building sites when the bricklayers were finished, put his large hands around the ends of the protruding steel used to reinforce the concrete, and with one quick, practiced movement, bent the ends of the steel poles and wove them into each other. He had seen his father working. It looked like he was wringing a cloth. No one had invented a machine that did the job better. He squeezed his eyes shut as he heard his father scream out in pain and anguish, "Take the boy out!" But he asked, "Out!" The doctor's voice. "The bleeding has stopped. Let's get cracking now." Someone grabbed him under the arms and lifted him. He tried to struggle, but he was so small, so light. And that was when he noticed the smell. Burned flesh and blood. The last thing he heard was the doctor's voice. "Saw, please." The door slammed behind him, and he sank down onto his knees and continued to pray where his mother had left off. "Save him. Maim him, but save him." God had the power to do things like that, if it was his wish. He felt someone watching him, opened his eyes, and was back in the metro. On the seat opposite was a woman with taut jaw muscles and a weary, distant gaze that moved away when it met his. The second hand on his wristwatch jerked forward as he repeated the address to himself. He felt his pulse. Normal. His head was light, but not too light. He was neither hot nor cold, felt neither fear nor pleasure, neither satisfaction nor dissatisfaction. The train was slowing down. Charles de Gaulle Étoile. He sent the woman a final glance. She had been studying him. But if she should ever meet him again, maybe even tonight, she still would not recognize him. He got to his feet and waited by the doors. The brakes gave a low lament. Urinal blocks and urine. And freedom. As impossible to imagine as a smell. The doors slid open. Harry stepped onto the platform and stood inhaling the warm underground air as he read the address on the slip of paper. He heard the doors close and felt the draft of air on his back as the train set off again. Then he walked toward the exit. An advertisement over the escalator told him there were ways of avoiding colds. "Like hell there are," he coughed, stuffing a hand down the deep pocket of his wool coat, and finding the pack of cigarettes under the hip flask and the tin of throat lozenges. The cigarette bobbed up and down in his mouth as he walked through the glass exit door, leaving the raw, unnatural heat of Oslo's underground behind him, and ran up the steps to Oslo's ultra-natural December darkness and freezing temperatures. Harry instinctively shrank. Egger Torge. This small open square was an intersection between pedestrian streets in the heart of Oslo, if the city could be said to have a heart at this time of the year. Shops were open this Sunday, since it was the penultimate weekend before Christmas, and the square was teeming with people hurrying to and fro in the yellow light that fell from the windows of the surrounding modest three-story shops. Harry saw the bags of wrapped presents and made a mental note to buy something for Bjarne Müller, whose last day at Police HQ was tomorrow. Harry's boss and chief protector in the police force for all these years was at long last realizing his plans to reduce his hours, and from next week onward would take over as a so-called senior special investigator at the Bergen police station, which meant in reality that Bjarne Müller could do as he liked until he retired. Cushy setup, but Bergen? Rain and dank mountains. Müller didn't even come from Bergen. Harry had always liked, but not always appreciated, Bjarne Müller. A man dressed head to toe in a down jacket and trousers slowly waddled past like an astronaut, grinning and blowing frosted breath from round, pink cheeks, stooped shoulders and closed winter faces. Harry spotted a pallid-faced woman wearing a thin black leather jacket with holes in the elbows, standing by the jeweler's, hopping from one foot to the other as her eyes searched, hoping to find her supplier soon. A beggar, long-haired and unshaven, but well-covered in warm, fashionable, youthful clothing, sat in a yoga position, leaning against a lamppost, his head bent forward as if in meditation, with a brown paper cup from a cappuccino bar in front of him. Harry had seen more and more beggars over the last year, and it had struck him that they all looked the same. Even the paper cups were identical, as though it were a secret code. Perhaps they were creatures from outer space quietly taking over his town, his streets. No problem. Feel free. Harry entered the jeweler's shop. "Can you fix this?" he said to the young man behind the counter, passing him his grandfather's watch. Harry had been given it when he was a boy in Andalsnes, the day they had buried his mother. He had almost been frightened, but his granddad had reassured him that watches were the sort of thing you gave away, and Harry should remember to pass it on, before it's too late. Harry had forgotten all about the watch until Oleg visited him in his flat on Sofiaskata, and had seen the silver watch in a drawer while he was looking for Harry's Game Boy. Oleg, who was 10 years old, but had long had the measure of Harry at their shared passion, the rather outdated computer game Tetris, was suddenly oblivious to the duel he had been looking forward to, and instead sat fiddling with the watch, trying to make it go. "It's broken," Harry said. "Ugh," Oleg answered. "Everything can be repaired." Harry hoped in his heart of hearts that this contention was true, but he had days when he had severe doubts. Nonetheless, he had wondered in a vague way whether he should introduce Oleg to Jorka and Valentinerna and their album, Everything Can Be Repaired. However, on reflection, Harry had concluded that Oleg's mother, Raquel, was unlikely to appreciate the connection. Her ex-alcoholic lover passing on songs about being an alcoholic, written and sung by a now-dead junkie. "Can you repair it?" he asked the young man behind the counter. By way of an answer, nimble, expert hands opened the watch. "Not worth it. Not worth it. If you go to an antique shop, they have better working watches and they cost less than it would to have this fixed." "Do it anyway," Harry said. "Okay," said the young man, who had already started examining the internal mechanisms and, in fact, seemed pretty pleased with Harry's decision. "Come back on Tuesday." On leaving the shop, Harry heard the frail sound of a single guitar string through an amplifier. It rose when the guitarist, a boy with scraggly facial hair and fingerless gloves, turned one of the tuning keys. It was time for one of the traditional pre-Christmas concerts, when well-known artists performed on behalf of the Salvation Army in Egger Torge. People had already begun to gather in front of the band as it took up a position behind the Salvation Army's black Christmas kettle, a cooking pot that hung from three poles in the middle of the square. "Is that you?" Harry turned. It was the woman with the junky eyes.
It's you, isn't it? Have you come instead of Snoopy? I need a fix right away of...
Sorry, Harry interrupted. It's not me you want. She stared at him. Leaning her head to one side, she narrowed her eyes, as though appraising whether he was lying to her.
Yeah, I've seen you somewhere before.
I'm a policeman. She paused. Harry breathed in. There was a delayed reaction, as if the message had to follow detours around scorched neurons and smashed synapses. Then the dull glow of hatred that Harry had been waiting for lit up in her eyes.
The cops! Thought we had a deal. You were supposed to stay in the square, in Plata, Harry said, looking past her at the vocalist.
Huh, said the woman, standing straight in front of Harry. You're not in narcotics. You're the guy on the TV who killed...
Crime Squad. Harry took her by the arm. Listen, you can get what you want in Plata. Don't force me to drag you into the station.
Cannot.
She tore her arm away. Harry held up both hands. Tell me you're not going to do any deals here, and I can go, okay? She cocked her head. The thin, anemic lips tightened a fraction. She seemed to see something amusing in the situation.
Should I tell you why I can't go to the square?
Harry waited.
Because my boy's down there.
He felt his stomach churn.
I don't want him to see me like this. Do you understand, cop?
Harry looked into her defiant face as he tried to formulate a sentence. Merry Christmas, he said, turning his back on her. Harry dropped his cigarette into the packed brown snow and walked off. He wanted this job off his back. He didn't see the people coming toward him, and staring down at the blue ice, as if they had a bad conscience, they didn't see him either, as if they, citizens of the world's most generous social democracy, were nonetheless ashamed.
Because my boy's down there.
On Fredensborgveien, beside Oslo's Deichmanske Public Library, Harry stopped outside the street number that was scrawled on the envelope he was carrying. He leaned back and looked up. The facade was grey and black, and had recently been repainted. A graffiti artist's wet dream. Christmas decorations were already hanging from some of the windows, like silhouettes against the gentle yellow light, in what seemed like warm, secure homes. And perhaps they are indeed that, Harry forced himself to think. Forced, because you can't be in the police for 12 years without being infected by the contempt for humanity that comes with the territory. But he did fight against it. You had to give him that. He found the name by the bell, closed his eyes and tried to find the right words. It didn't help. Her voice was still in the way.
I don't want him to see me like this.
Harry gave up. Is there a right way to formulate the impossible? He pressed his thumb against the cold metal button, and somewhere inside the building it rang. Captain John Carson took his finger off the button, put the heavy plastic bags down on the pavement, and gazed up at the front of the building. The flats looked as if they had been under siege from light artillery. Big chunks of plaster had fallen off, and the windows of a burnt-out flat on the second floor had been boarded up. At first, he had walked right past Fredriksson's blue house. The cold seemed to have sucked all the color out of the buildings and made all the house fronts on Hausmannsgatter the same. It was only when he saw Festbreden, West Bank, scrawled on the wall of a squatter's building that he realized he had walked too far. A crack in the glass of the front door was shaped like a V. V for victory. John shivered in his windbreaker and was glad the Salvation Army uniform underneath was made of pure, thick wool. When John had gone to be measured for his new uniform after officer training school, none of the regular sizes had fit him, so he had been issued some material and sent to a tailor, who blew smoke into his face and said, apropos of nothing, that he rejected Jesus as his personal redeemer. However, the tailor did a good job, and John thanked him warmly. He was not used to made-to-measure clothes. That was why he had a stoop, it was said. Those who saw him coming up Hausmannsgatter that afternoon might well have thought he was bent over to keep out of the ice-cold December wind that was sweeping icicles and frozen litter along the pavement as the heavy traffic thundered by. But those who knew him said that John Carlson stooped to take the edge off his height and to reach down to those smaller than him, as he did now, to drop the 20-kroner coin in the brown paper cup held by a filthy, trembling hand next to the doorway. "How's it going?" John asked the human bundle, sitting cross-legged on a piece of cardboard in the swirling snow.
"I'm in the line for methadone treatment,"
the piteous person said in a halting, monotonous voice, as if reciting an ill-rehearsed psalm, while staring at John's black-uniformed knees.
"You should go down to our cafe on Utagata," John said. "Warm up a bit and get some food and..."
The rest was drowned out by the roar of the traffic, as the lights behind them changed to green.
"No time," the bundle replied. "You wouldn't have a 50 note, would you?"
John never ceased to be surprised by drug addicts' unwavering focus. He sighed and thrust a 100-krona note in the cup.
"See if you can find some warm clothes at Freitex. If not, we've got some new winter jackets at the lighthouse. You'll freeze to death in that thin denim jacket."
He was resigned to the fact that he was speaking to someone who already knew the gift would be used to buy dope. But so what? It was the same refrain, yet another of the irresolvable moral dilemmas that filled his days. John pressed the bell once again. He saw his reflection in the dirty shop window beside the doorway. Taya said he was a big man. He wasn't big at all. He was small. A small soldier. But when he was finished, the little soldier would sprint down Mølleveien, across the Akerselva River, where East Oslo and Grønløkka started, over Sofienberg Park, to 4 Göteborgata, which the army owned and rented out to its employees, unlock the door to entrance B, say hello to one of the other tenants he hoped would assume he was on his way to his flat on the 4th floor. However, he would take the elevator to the 5th, go through the loft space to the A building, make sure the coast was clear, then head for Taya's door and tap out their prearranged signal, and she would open the door and her arms, into which he could creep and thaw out. Something was trembling. At first he thought it was the ground, the city, the foundations. He put down the bag and delved into his pocket. His cell phone was vibrating in his hand. The display showed Ranhild's number. It was the third time today. He knew he could not put it off any longer. He would have to tell her that he and Teo were getting engaged, when he had found the right words. He put the phone back in his pocket and avoided looking at his reflection. But he made up his mind. He would stop being a coward. He would be frank. Be a big soldier. For Teo on Göteborgata. For his father in Thailand. For the Lord above.
"Yes?" came the shout from the loudspeaker above the bells.
"Oh, hi. This is John.
Huh?
John from the Salvation Army."
John waited.
"What do you want?"
the voice crackled.
"I've got some food for you. I thought you might need. Got any cigarettes?"
John swallowed and stamped his boots in the snow.
"No, I only had enough money for food this time."
"Shit."
It went quiet again.
"Hello?" John shouted.
Yeah, I'm thinking. If you want, I'll come back later."
The mechanism buzzed, and John quickly pushed open the door. Inside the stairwell, there were newspapers, empty bottles, and frozen yellow pools of urine. Thanks to the cold weather, John did not have to brave the pervasive, bittersweet stench that filled the hallway on milder days. He tried to walk without making much noise, but his footsteps reverberated on the stairs anyway. The woman standing in the doorway and waiting for him was ogling the bags. To avoid looking him in the eye, John thought. She had that same bloated, swollen face that came with many years of addiction, was overweight, and wore a filthy white T-shirt under her bathrobe. A stale smell emanated from the door. John stopped on the landing and put down the bags. "Is your husband in too?"
"Yes, he's in,"
she said in mellifluous French. She was good-looking, high cheekbones and large almond-shaped eyes, narrow, bloodless lips, and well-dressed. At any rate, the part of her he could see through the crack in the door was well-dressed. Instinctively, he adjusted his red neckerchief. The security lock between them was made of solid brass and attached to a heavy oak door without a nameplate. While standing outside the building on Avenue Carnot and waiting for the concierge to open the door, he had noticed that everything seemed new and expensive, the door furniture, the bells, the cylinder locks, and the fact that the pale yellow facade and the white shutters were covered in an unsightly, dirty layer of black pollution, served to emphasize the established and solid nature of this district of Paris even more. Original oil paintings hung in the hallway.
"What do you want?"
The eyes and the intonation were neither friendly nor unfriendly, but contained perhaps a smidgen of skepticism because of his terrible French pronunciation. "A message, madame." She hesitated, but acted as expected in the end. "All right. Could you wait here, please, and I'll get him." She shut the door and the lock fell into position with a well-oiled click. He stamped his feet. He ought to learn to speak better French. His mother had force-fed him English in the evenings, but she had never sorted out his French. He stared at the door. French underwear. French letter. Good-looking. He thought about Georgi. Georgi of the White Smile was 1 year older than he was, so 28 now. Was he still as good-looking? Blonde and small and pretty like a girl? He had been in love with Georgi, in the unprejudiced, unconditional way that only children can fall in love. He heard steps coming from inside. A man's steps. Someone fiddling with the lock. A blue connecting line between work and freedom. From here to soap and urine. The snow would come soon. He prepared himself. The man's face appeared in the doorway. "What the fuck do you want?" John lifted the plastic bags and ventured a smile. "Fresh bread. Smells good, doesn't it?" Fredrickson laid a large brown hand on the woman's shoulder and pushed her away. "All I can smell is Christian blood." It was said with clear, sober diction, but the washed-out irises in the bearded face told a different story. The eyes tried to focus on the shopping bags. He looked like a large, powerful man who had shrunk inside. His skeleton and even his cranium had become smaller inside the skin that drooped, three sizes too big from the malevolent face. Fredrickson ran a grubby finger over the fresh cuts along the bridge of his nose. "You're not going to preach now, are you?"
"No, actually I wanted..."
"Oh, come on, soldier. You want something back for this, don't you? My soul, for example."
John shivered in his uniform. "It's not me who deals with souls, Fredrickson, but I can arrange for food, so..."
"Oh, you can manage a little sermon first."
"As I said,
a sermon."
John stood looking at Fredrickson.
"Give us a sermon with that wet little cunt-hole of yours," Fredrickson yelled. "A sermon, so that we can eat with a good conscience, you condescending Christian bastard. Come on, get it over with. What's God's message today?"
John opened his mouth and closed it again, swallowed, tried again, and this time his vocal cords responded. "The message is that he gave his only son, who died, for our sins."
"You're lying."
"No, I'm afraid I'm not," Harry said, observing the terrified face of the man in the doorway in front of him.
There was a smell of lunch and a rattle of cutlery in the background. A family man, a father, until now. The man scratched his forearm and gazed at a spot above Harry's head, as if someone were there. The scratching made an unpleasant rasping noise. The rattle of cutlery had stopped. The shuffle of feet came to a halt behind the man, and a small hand was placed on his shoulder. A woman's face with large red eyes peeped out.
"What is it, Birrier?"
"This policeman has something to tell us,"
Birrier said in a monotone.
"What?"
the woman said, looking at Harry.
"Is it about our son? Is it about Père?"
"Yes, Fru Holman,"
Harry said, and saw the fear steal into her eyes. He searched for the impossible words. "We found him 2 hours ago. Your son is dead." He had to look away.
"But he... where?"
Her eyes jumped from Harry to the man who kept scratching his arm. "Won't be long before he draws blood," Harry thought, and cleared his throat.
"In a container by the harbour. What we feared. He's been dead for a good while."
Birger Holman seemed to lose his balance, staggered backward into the lit hallway and grabbed a coat rack. The woman stepped forward and Harry saw the man fall to his knees behind her. Harry breathed in and shoved his hand inside his coat. The metal hip flask was ice cold against his fingertips. He found what he was looking for and pulled out an envelope. He hadn't written the letter, but knew the contents all too well. The brief official notification of death, stripped of all the verbiage. The bureaucratic act of pronouncing death.
"I'm sorry, but it's my job to give you this."
"Your job to do what?" said the small middle-aged man with the exaggerated, mundane French pronunciation, characteristic not of the upper classes, but of those who strive to belong.
The visitor studied him. Everything matched the photograph in the envelope, even the mean-spirited tie knot and the loose red smoking jacket. He didn't know what this man had done wrong. He doubted it had been physical, because despite the irritation in his expression, his body language was defensive, almost anxious, even in the doorway to his own home. Had he been stealing money, embezzling? He could be the type to work with figures, but not the big sums. His attractive wife notwithstanding, he looked more like the kind who helped himself to small change here and there. He might have been unfaithful, might have slept with the wife of the wrong man. No. As a rule, short men with above-average assets and wives much more attractive than themselves were more concerned with her infidelity. The man annoyed him. He slipped his hand into his pocket. "This," he said, resting the barrel of a Lama Minimax, which he had bought for just 300 euros on the taut brass door chain, "is my job." He pointed the silencer. It was a plain metal tube made by a gunsmith in Zagreb and screwed to the barrel. The black duct tape lashed around where the two parts met was to make it airtight. Of course, he could have bought a so-called quality silencer for over 100 euros, but why? No one could silence the sound of a bullet breaking the sound barrier, of the hot gas meeting the cold air, and the mechanical metal parts striking each other. Pistols with silencers that sounded like popcorn under a lid were pure Hollywood. The explosion was like the crack of a whip. He pressed his face against the narrow opening. The man in the photo was gone. He had fallen backward without a sound. The hall was dark, but in the wall mirror he saw the sliver of light from the door, and his magnified eye framed in gold. The dead man lay on a thick burgundy carpet. Persian? Perhaps he had had money, after all. Now he had a little hole in his forehead. He looked up and met the eyes of the wife, if she was his wife. She was standing in the doorway of another room. Behind her, a large yellow oriental lamp. She had her hand in front of her mouth and was staring at him. He gave a brief nod. Then he carefully closed the door, put the gun back in his shoulder holster, and began to walk down the stairs. He never used the elevator when he was making his getaway, or rented cars or motorbikes or anything else that could malfunction. And he didn't run. He didn't talk or shout. The voice could be identified. The getaway was the most critical part of the job, but also the part he loved best. It was like flying, a dreamless nothing. The concierge, a woman, had come out of her flat on the ground floor and watched him in bewilderment. He whispered an au revoir, madame, but she glared back in silence. When she was questioned by the police in an hour's time, they would ask her for a description, and she would oblige. A man, normal appearance, medium height, 20 years old, or 30, perhaps. Not 40, anyway, she thought. He emerged into the street. The low rumble of Paris, like thunder that never came any closer, but never stopped, either. He discarded his Lama Minimax in a garbage can he had chosen for the purpose beforehand. Two new unfired guns from the same manufacturer awaited his return in Zagreb. He had been given a bulk purchase discount. When the airport bus passed Porte de la Chapelle half an hour later, on the highway between Paris and Charles de Gaulle, the air was full of snowflakes. They settled on the scattered strands of pale yellow straw pointing stiffly upward to the grey sky. After checking in for his flight and going through security, he went straight to the men's restroom. He stood at the end of the line of white bowls, unbuttoned and sprayed the white urinal blocks at the bottom of the bowl. He closed his eyes and concentrated on the sweet smell of paradichlorobenzene and the lemon fragrance enhancer from the J&J Chemicals Company. The connecting line to freedom had one stop left. He rolled the name on his tongue. Oslo. 3. Sunday, December 14th. The Bite. In the red zone on the sixth floor of Police HQ, the concrete and glass colossus with the largest concentration of police in Norway, Harry sat back in his chair in room 605. This was the office that Halvorsen, the young policeman Harry shared the 30 square feet with, liked to call the clearinghouse, and that Harry, when Halvorsen had to be taken down a peg or two, called in-house training. But at this moment, Harry was on his own, staring at the wall where the window might have been if the clearinghouse had such a thing. It was Sunday. He had written the report and could go home. So why didn't he? Through the imaginary window he saw the fenced-off harbour in Bjørvika, where fresh snow lay like confetti on the green, red and blue containers. The case had been solved. Per Holmen, a young heroin addict, had had enough of life and had taken his final shot inside a container, from a gun. No external signs of violence, the gun down by his side. As far as the undercover boys knew, Per Holmen did not owe any money. When dealers execute junkies with debts, they don't usually try to camouflage it as something else. Quite the contrary. A cut-and-dried case of suicide, then. So why waste the evening ferreting around a grim, wind-blown container terminal where all he would find was more sorrow and grief? Harry looked at his wool coat hanging on the coat rack. The small hip flask in the inside pocket was full, and untouched since he'd gone to the liquor store in October, bought a bottle of his worst enemy, Jim Beam, and filled his flask before emptying the rest down the sink. Since then he had carried the poison on him, a bit like the way the Nazis kept cyanide pills in the soles of their shoes. Why bother with such a stupid idea? He didn't know. He didn't have to know. It worked. Harry looked at the clock. Almost 11. At home, he had a much-used espresso machine and a DVD he had put by for just such an evening as this. All about Eve, Mankiewicz's 1950 masterpiece with Betty Davis and George Sanders. He took an internal reading and knew it was going to be the harbour. Harry had turned up the lapels of his coat and stood with his back to the north wind that blew right through the tall fence in front of him and formed snowdrifts around the containers on the inside. The harbour area and the large empty expanses looked like a desert at night. The enclosed container terminal was illuminated, but the lampposts swayed in the gusting wind, and the metal boxes piled up in twos or threes cast shadows over the streets. The particular one Harry had his eye on was red, and represented something of a color clash with the orange police tape. But it was a great refuge on a December night in Oslo, with almost identical measurements and the same level of comfort as the holding cells at Police HQ. The report by the crime scene unit, though it was hardly a unit, numbering one detective and one technician, said the container had stood empty for a while, unlocked. The site watchman had explained that they didn't bother much about locking empty containers, since the area was fenced off and, furthermore, under surveillance. Nevertheless, a drug addict had got in. Per Holmen, he supposed, had been one of the many who had hung out around Bjørvika, which was a mere stone's throw from the junkie supermarket in Plata. Perhaps the watchman had turned a blind eye to their using the containers as a place to stay? Perhaps he knew that in so doing, he had saved the odd life or two? There was no lock on the container, but there was a big fat padlock on the gate in the fence. Harry regretted that he hadn't called from HQ to say he was coming. If there were any guards here, he couldn't see them. Harry checked his watch, deliberated and surveyed the top of the fence. He was in good shape, better than in a long time. He hadn't touched alcohol since the catastrophe last summer, and he had been training on a regular basis in the police gym. More than regular. Before the snow came, he had broken Tom Wohler's old steeplechase record in Erkern. A few days later, Halvorsen had cautiously asked if all the training had anything to do with Raquel, because his impression was that they weren't seeing each other anymore. Harry had explained to the young officer, in a curt yet clear way, that they might share an office, but they did not share a private life. Halvorsen had shrugged, asked who else Harry talked to, and had his assumption confirmed when Harry got up and marched out of room 605. 9 feet, no barbed wire, easy. Harry caught hold of the fence as high as he could, put his feet against the fence post and straightened up. Right arm up, then left, hung with arms outstretched until his feet got a grip. Caterpillar movements. He swung himself over to the other side. He raised the bolt and pulled open the door of the container, took out his solid black army flashlight, ducked under the police tape and went in. It was eerily quiet inside. Sound seemed to have been frozen too. Harry switched on the flashlight and shone it inside the container. In the cone of light, he could see the chalk outline on the floor where they had found Holmen. Beate Lern, the young head of Krimtechnisch, the forensics department in the new building on Brinsaleen, had shown him the pictures. Holmen had been sitting with his back to the wall with a hole in his right temple and the gun on his right. Very little blood. That was the advantage of shots to the head. The only one. The gun fired ammunition of a modest caliber, so the entry wound was small, and there was no exit wound. Forensics would find the bullet in the skull, where it would have bounced around like a pinball, and pulped what Per Holman had once thought with, made this decision with, and at the end ordered his forefinger to press the trigger with. Incomprehensible, his colleagues tended to say when they discovered young people who had chosen to take their own lives. Harry assumed they said that to protect themselves, to reject the whole idea of it. If not, he didn't understand what they meant by its being incomprehensible. All the same, that was the word he himself had used this afternoon, standing at the entrance and looking down the hallway at Holman's father on his knees, his back bent, shaking with sobs. And since Harry had had no words of comfort to say about death, God, redemption, life afterward, or the sense of it all, he had just mumbled the same feeble, incomprehensible. Harry switched off the flashlight and put it in his coat pocket. The darkness closed in around him. He thought of his own father, Olaf Hall, the retired teacher and widower living in a house in Uppsala, of how his eyes lit up when Harry, or Sis, visited him once a month, and how the light slowly faded as they drank coffee and talked about things of little import. Anything of meaning had pride of place in a photo on the piano she had once played. Olaf Hall did almost nothing now, read his books, about countries and empires he would never see, and in fact no longer had any desire to see, since she could not join him. The greatest loss of all, he said on the few occasions they talked about her, and what Harry was thinking about now was what Olaf Hall would call the day they went to tell him his son was dead. Harry left the container and walked toward the fence, grabbed hold of it with his hands. Then there was one of those strange moments of sudden, total silence, when the wind catches its breath to listen or change its mind, and all that is heard is the reassuring rumble of the town in the winter darkness. That, and the sound of wind-borne paper scraping against the pavement. But the wind had dropped. It wasn't paper. It was steps. Quick, light steps. Lighter than footsteps. Pause. Harry's heart accelerated out of control, and facing the fence, he bent his knees lightning quick and straightened up. Only afterward would it occur to him what had made him so frightened. It was the silence, and the fact that he heard nothing in this silence. No growling, no signs of aggression, as though whatever it was out there in the dark did not want to frighten him. Quite the contrary, it was hunting him. Had Harry known much about dogs, he might have been aware that there was one kind of dog that never growls, neither when it is frightened nor when it attacks. The male of the black Metzner species. Harry stretched his arms upward and was bending his knees again when he heard the change in rhythm and then silence, and he knew it had launched itself. He pushed upward. The claim that you don't feel pain when terror has pumped the blood full of adrenaline is, at best, somewhat less than accurate. Harry let out a yell when the teeth of the large, lean dog gripped the flesh of his right leg and sank farther and farther in until finally they were pressing on the sensitive tissue membrane around the bone. The wire fence sang. Gravity pulled at them both, but in sheer desperation Harry managed to hang on. By normal standards, he would have been safe by now, because any other dog weighing as much as a mature black Metzner would have let go. But a black Metzner has teeth and jaw muscles that can crush bone, hence its alleged reputation as a relative of the bone-devouring speckled hyena. So it hung there, bolted to Harry's leg by two canine teeth, set backward in the upper jaw and one in the lower jaw, which stabilized the bite. It had broken the second canine in the lower jaw on a steel prosthesis when it was just 3 months old. Harry managed to put his left elbow over the edge of the fence and tried to drag them both up, but the dog had one paw in the wire. With his right hand he groped for his coat pocket, found it, and then grabbed the rubber shaft of the flashlight. He looked down and for the first time saw the animal. The black eyes in the equally black face had a dull sheen. Harry swung the flashlight. It hit the dog on the head right between its ears, and so hard that he heard a crunch. He raised the flashlight and struck again, hitting the sensitive snout. Struck out in desperation at the eyes, which still had not blinked. He lost hold of the flashlight and it fell to the ground. The dog was still hanging from his leg. Soon Harry would not have the strength to hold on to the fence. He did not want to think about what might happen then, but was unable to stop himself.
Help!
Harry's feeble cry was carried away on the wind that had sprung up again. He changed grip and felt a sudden urge to laugh. Surely it couldn't all end like this. Being found in a container terminal with his throat savaged by a guard dog. Harry took a deep breath. The jagged points from the wire netting were digging into his armpit. His fingers were wilting fast. He was seconds away from letting go. If only he had a weapon. If only he had had a bottle instead of the hip flask, he could have smashed it and used it to stab with. The hip flask. Summoning his last strength, Harry reached inside his coat and pulled out the flask. He stuffed the spout into his mouth, clenched his teeth on the metal top, and twisted. The top loosened, and he held it between his teeth as the whiskey filled his mouth. A shock ran through his body. Christ! He pressed his face against the fence, forcing his eyes closed, and the distant lights of the plaza and opera hotels became white stripes in all the darkness. With his right hand, he lowered the flask until it was above the dog's red jaws. Then he spat out the top and the whiskey, mumbled "Skål," and emptied the flask. For 2 long seconds, the black, doggy eyes stared up at Harry in total perplexity as the brown liquid gurgled and trickled down Harry's leg into the open jaws. The animal relinquished its hold. Harry heard the smack of living flesh on bare pavement, followed by a kind of death rattle and low whimpering, then the scratching sound of paws, and the dog was swallowed up by the dark from which it had emerged. Harry swung his legs over the fence. He rolled up his trouser leg. Even without the flashlight, he knew the evening was going to be spent in the emergency room, and not watching All About Eve. John lay with his head in Taya's lap, and his eyes closed, enjoying the regular drone of the TV. It was one of these series she liked so much. King of the Bronx. Or was it The King of Queens?
"Have you asked your brother if he would do your shift in Egertorge?" Thea asked.
She had placed a hand over his eyes. He could smell the sweet fragrance of her skin, which meant that she had just given herself a shot of insulin.
"Which shift?" John asked.
She snatched away her hand and stared at him in disbelief. John laughed.
"Relax. I spoke to Robert ages ago. He agreed."
She gave a groan of resignation. John grabbed her hand and put it back over his eyes.
"I didn't say it was your birthday, though," he said. "If I had, I'm not sure he would have agreed."
"Why not?"
"Because he's crazy about you, and you know it. That's what you say."
"And you don't like him."
"That's not true."
"Why do you always go stiff whenever I mention his name, then?"
She laughed out loud. Must have been something in the Bronx, or Queens.
"Did you get a table at the restaurant?"
she asked.
"Yes."
She smiled and squeezed his hand. Then she furrowed her brow.
"I've been thinking. Someone might see us there."
"From the army?"
"Out of the question." "What if they do?"
John didn't answer.
"Perhaps it's time we went public," she said.
"I don't know," he said.
"Isn't it best to wait until we're absolutely sure that..."
"Aren't you sure, John?"
John moved her hand and looked up at her in dismay.
"Taya, please.
You know very well that I love you above all else. That's not the point."
"What is the point, then?"
John sighed and sat up beside her.
"You don't know Robert, Taya."
She gave a wry smile.
"I've known him since we were tiny, John."
John squirmed.
"Yes, but there are things you don't know. You don't know how angry he can get. He takes after Dad. He can be dangerous, Taya."
She leaned back against the wall and stared into the air.
"I suggest we defer it for a while."
John wrung his hands.
"Out of consideration for your brother, too."
"Rickard?"
she said, surprised.
"Yes.
What would he say if you, his own sister, announced your engagement to me right now?"
"Ah, I see what you mean.
Since you're both competing for the head of admin job."
"You know very well that the High Council sets great store by high-ranking officers having a respectable officer as their spouse.
It's obvious that the right thing to do, from a tactical point of view, would be to announce my marriage to Thea Nielsen, the daughter of Frank Nielsen, the commander's right hand. But would it be morally right?"
Thea chewed her bottom lip.
"Why is this job so important to you and Rickard?"
John shrugged. "The army has paid our way through officer training school and 4 years for an economics degree at a school of management.
I suppose Rickard thinks the way I do. You have a duty to apply for Salvation Army jobs seeking your qualifications. Maybe neither of you will get it. Dad says no one under 35 has ever been appointed head of admin.
I know. John sighed. Don't tell anyone. But actually, I would be relieved if Rickard got the job.
Relieved? Taya said.
You? You've had the responsibility for all the rental property in Oslo for over a year now.
That's right. But the head of admin has all of Norway, Iceland and the Faroes. Did you know that the Army's property company owns over 250 plots, with 300 buildings, in Norway alone?
John patted himself on the stomach and stared at the ceiling with a familiar, concerned expression.
I saw my reflection in a shop window today and it struck me how small I am.
Thea did not seem to have heard.
Someone told Rickard that whoever gets the job will be the next territorial commander.
John laughed out loud.
I definitely do not want that.
Don't fool around, John. I'm not fooling around, Thea. You and I are much more important. I'm saying I'm not interested in the admin job, so let's announce our engagement. I can do other important work. Lots of the corps need economists too. No, John,
Thea said, horrified.
You're the best we've got. You have to be employed where we need you most. Rickard is my brother, but he doesn't have your intelligence.
We can wait until the decision has been made to tell them about the engagement.
John shrugged.
Thea looked at the clock. You'll have to leave before 12 today. In the elevator yesterday, Emma said she had been worried about me because she had heard my door open and close in the middle of the night.
John swung his legs onto the floor. I don't understand why we bother living here. She sent John a reproving glance.
At least we can take care of each other here.
Right, he sighed. We take care of each other.
Good night, then.
She wriggled over to him and slipped her hand up his shirt, and, to his surprise, he could feel that her hand was sweaty, as if she had been clenching it or squeezing something. She pressed herself against him, and her breathing began to quicken.
Thea, he said, we mustn't.
She went rigid. Then she sighed and took her hand away. John was amazed. So far, Thea had not exactly come on to him. More the opposite. She had seemed anxious about physical contact, and he valued that modesty. She had seemed reassured after their first date, when he had quoted the statutes and said, "The Salvation Army considers abstinence before marriage a Christian ideal." Even though many thought there was a difference between ideal and command, which the statutes used when referring to tobacco and alcohol, he saw no reason to break a promise to God because of nuances. He gave her a hug, stood up and went to the bathroom, locked the door behind him and turned on the tap, let the water run over his hands as he regarded the smooth surface of molten sand reflecting the face of a person who, to all outward appearances, ought to be happy. He had to call Ranhild, get it over with. John took a deep breath. He was happy. It was just that some days were harder than others. He dried his face and went back to her. The waiting area of Oslo's emergency room at 40 Storgata was bathed in harsh white light. There was the usual human menagerie at this time of day. A trembling drug addict stood up and left 20 minutes after Harry arrived. As a rule, they couldn't sit still for longer than 10. Harry could understand that. He still had the taste of whiskey in his mouth. It had stirred up his old friends, who heaved and tugged at the chains below. His leg hurt like hell, and the trip to the harbour had yielded, like 90% of all police work, nothing. He promised himself he would keep the appointment with Betty Davis next time.
Harry Hole?
Harry looked up at the man in the white coat in front of him.
Yes? Could you come with me?
Thank you, but I think it's her turn, Harry said, nodding toward a girl with her head in her hands in the row of chairs opposite. The man leaned forward.
It's the second time she's been here this evening. She'll survive.
Harry limped down the corridor after the doctor's white coat and into a narrow examining room, with a desk and a plain bookshelf. He saw no personal items.
I thought you police had your own medicine men, the coat said.
Fat chance. Usually we don't even get priority in the line. How do you know I'm a policeman?
Sorry, I'm Matthias. I was on my way through the waiting room and spotted you.
The doctor smiled and reached out his hand. He had regular teeth, Harry saw. So regular you could have suspected him of wearing dentures. if the rest of his face had not been as symmetrical, clean, and square. The eyes were blue, with tiny laugh lines around them, and the handshake firm and dry. Straight out of a doctor novel, Harry thought. A doctor with warm hands. Matthias Lund Helgeson, the man added, taking stock of Harry. I realize you think I should know who you are, Harry said. We've met before, last summer, at a garden party at Raquel's place. Harry went rigid at the sound of her name on someone else's lips. Is that right? That was me, Matthias Lund Helgeson gabbled in a low voice. Harry gave a slow nod. I'm bleeding. I understand. Lund Helgeson's face wrapped itself in grave, sympathetic folds. Harry rolled up his trouser leg. Here.
Aha!
Lund Helgeson assumed a somewhat bemused smile. What is it? A dog bite. Can you fix it?
Not a lot to fix. The bleeding will stop. I'll clean the wounds and put something on it.
He bent down. Three wounds, I can see, judging by the teeth marks. And you'd better get a tetanus shot. It bit right through to the bone.
Yes, it often feels like that.
No, I mean its teeth did go. Harry paused and exhaled through his nose. He had just realized that Matthias Lund Helgeson thought he was drunk. And why shouldn't he? A policeman with a torn coat, a dog bite, a bad reputation, and alcohol on his breath. Was that what he would say when he told Raquel that her ex had turned to drink again? Right through, Harry finished. 4. Monday, December 15th. The departure.
Zirka.
He sat up in bed with a start, hearing the echo of his voice between the bare white hotel walls. The telephone on his bedside table rang. He snatched at the receiver.
This is your wake-up call.
Hvala, he said, although he knew it was only a recorded voice. He was in Zagreb. He was going to Oslo today, to the most important job, the final one. He closed his eyes. He had been dreaming again, not about Paris, not about any of the other jobs. He never dreamed about them. It was always about Vukovar, always about the autumn, about the siege. Last night he had dreamed about running. As usual, he had been running in the rain, and, as usual, it had been the same evening they sawed off his father's arm in the infants' ward. 4 hours later, his father had died, even though the doctors had pronounced the operation a success. They said his heart had just stopped beating, and then he had run away from his mother, into the dark and the rain, down to the river, with his father's gun in his hand, to the Serbian positions, and they had sent up flares and shot at him, and he hadn't cared, and he'd heard the smack of the bullets into the ground, which had disappeared beneath his feet, and he had fallen into the huge bomb crater. The water had swallowed him up, swallowed all sound, and it was quiet, and he had kept running under the water, but he got nowhere. As he'd felt his limbs stiffening and sleep numbing him, he had seen something red moving in all the blackness, like a bird beating its wings in slow motion. When he had come to, he was wrapped in a wool blanket, and a naked light bulb was swinging to and fro. A Serbian artillery pounded them, and small lumps of earth and plaster had fallen into his eyes and mouth. He spat, and someone had stooped down and told him that Bobo, the captain himself, had saved his life in the water-filled crater, and pointed to a bald man standing by the steps of the bunker. He had been wearing a uniform with a red cloth tied around his neck. He opened his eyes again and looked at the thermometer he had put on the bedside table. The temperature in the room had not risen above 60 degrees since November, even though in reception they maintained that the heat was fully on. He got up. He had to hurry. The airport bus would be outside the hotel in half an hour. He stared into the mirror over the basin and tried to visualize Bobo's face. But it was like the northern lights. Little by little it faded as he stared. The telephone rang again. Da.